Amen. Great to gather together as always. I wasn't here last Sunday. I was back on the Jersey Shore speaking at a conference for a radio station back there, Bridge Radio. And we've been on that station for a while, but I had been hearing from people who were listening to me on that station, and they got saved. And so I thought, well, when they asked me to come back, I thought, well, that'll be good. And going back there was nice because I met like a bunch of people who normally I don't, you know, see, like people who listen to the radio around here, they aren't as likely to say something to you. But back there, it's like people who knew who I was because they heard me on the radio, and met several people who got saved listening to the radio program back there that goes all over the East Coast. And so it was cool, but it was on the way back. I was on an airplane during church, and I tried to listen to or watch church on video, and I did for a while, but the Wi-Fi on airplanes just keeps cutting out, and so I waited until I got home to actually watch it. But I was thankful for Pastor Ken's message on Jonah. It was really excellent, but it's good to be back with you for sure. Nothing beats this, definitely. Well, we're going through 1 Samuel, and you can turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 14 as we pick up. We've had a couple of weeks off of 1 Samuel, and we've been exploring the life of Saul, and later on, David's going to come into the picture pretty soon. He's going to start creeping into the picture, but so far it's been Saul, the first king of Israel. And, you know, we've seen Saul's a mixed bag. Usually he gets a bad rap, but as we've studied his life, we realized there were a lot of good things about Saul when God chose him. He was gifted, tall, strong, humble. He didn't really want leadership, which really is the first thing that you should look for in a political leader, is you don't want somebody who really wants the job, and he didn't. But there's a lot of good about him. But we began to see, when we were in chapter 13, a beginning of a kind of deterioration where he got kind of sloppy. He messed up with performing. It was a little arrogant on his part to perform the sacrifice when he wasn't really supposed to. And Samuel, you know, chewed Saul out and told him, because of this, your family isn't going to reign on the throne like they could have. And so, you know, we've seen him start to go down. Now, in that chapter, we saw his son Jonathan come into the picture. And Jonathan was a brave soldier. His dad took credit for what he had done, but he began to come on the scene. Now, as we come to chapter 14, we see the trajectory of King Saul and Jonathan, his son, who would later never become king, but he would be the best friend of David, who God would raise up. And you see the contrast between these two guys. Jonathan was not a chip off the old block at all. In a whole lot of ways, we'll see in this chapter, he's like the opposite of everything that his dad was. And as much as Saul is a guy that we go, oh man, you know, what a tragic story, Jonathan is a guy that you look at him and go, how in the world did this kid come from his dad? He's very opposite him in a lot of ways. And so we'll jump into this chapter and you'll see what I'm talking about. Beginning with verse 1, 1 Samuel 14. Now it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor — they would have an armor bearer that was like his bodyguard and assistant — and he goes, hey, and by the way, what's happening at this point? The Philistines are really powerful, superior weaponry, they have chariots, everything, and they're basically, God had given them victory over the Philistines, but the Philistines outnumbered them hugely, and they were still surrounding them, waiting to collapse on them. So they're just like, oh boy, what do we do now? And Jonathan goes to his buddy, hey, come on, let's go over to the Philistines' garrison that's on the other side. He didn't tell his dad. He goes, let's just go check out the Philistines. I don't know if he didn't tell his dad because he thought his dad would say no, or if he just thought his dad wouldn't care, or if he thought his dad, you know, it doesn't say. Maybe it was just Jonathan's just like, hey, let's do it. No need to bother my dad. So in the meantime, Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. So Saul's just sitting there, eating pomegranates, spitting seeds on his 600 buddies, not really doing anything for Israel. And so he's there. Jonathan has his armor bearer, and he goes, let's try something crazy. Oh, by the way, in verse 3, it does say that Ichabod's brother, Ahijah, who was a son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, so the grandson of Eli, who, remember, his brother was named Ichabod, which means the glory has departed. When everything was going downhill, this kid was there, and he was a priest, and he's still a priest, and he was Saul's priest. And so he's there on the scene wearing the ephod, wearing this body armor thing that had these magic, the Urim and the Thummim, these magic stones in there that they would use to find out the will of God. So in verse 4, it describes the region where Jonathan was. Nobody even knew that he was gone. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. So there were these two sheer cliffs of rock and a really narrow pass that you would go through. And it names the rocks, and one of them faced north and the other faced south. So the reason why that's important is Jonathan most likely is coming from the east because the Philistines were west of them. So it's morning, he's coming through this narrow passageway and the sun's behind him, so it's not easy for people to see him. So Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come on, let's go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. No need to get personal, but he did. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. This guy's a different sort of guy. He takes one guy with him and he goes, you know what? The only way we're going to win against the Philistines is if God helps us, because we're grossly outnumbered and outmanned and outweaponed. So God could just use a couple of us and we could do it if it's God. And so then he comes up with this plan that, well, the armor bearer goes, okay, I'm in. Whatever, and do all that's in your heart. I'm with you. Then Jonathan said, okay, let's cross over to where these Philistine soldiers are lined up, and we will show ourselves to them. We'll let them know that we'll make noise. They'll know that we're here. And verse 9, if they say this to us, wait until we come to you, then we're going to stay where we are. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up. For the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. So we don't know if God told Jonathan this. It doesn't say that. But it looks like he just floated this idea. He goes, okay, I'm going to give God a chance to either do a miracle or kill us. Because we're going to die anyhow. So here's the deal. As a sign, we're going to say, we're going to go make some noise. They're down there whistling Jewish folk songs. And when they hear us, then if they say, we're going to be right down there to deal with you, then like, okay, this isn't working. But if they say, hey, come on up, then we know that it's the Lord. And we know that this is going to happen. So, you know, a pretty bold line drawn in the sand. Here's the thing. Gives God a chance to work, gives them a chance to run if they need to, but he's doing something at least. And so armor bearers all in. And so then the guys, they showed themselves to the garrison, and the Philistines said, look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden, kind of insulting them. And then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we'll show you something. Hey, come here. You're going to see something. And Jonathan goes, that's our cue. That's it. God heard. He's going to do something. So this was a steep hill between these cliffs. So as you read on, it says that Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees, again, sun to his back. They can't really make out what's going on. He's just crawling, so they don't see him immediately. And when he comes to the first Philistine, he takes him down, tosses him over his shoulder, and then the armor bearer with the sword stuck him with the sword and killed him. And they worked their way up this hill one at a time, you know, with Jonathan taking the guy down and the armor bearer taking him out. And altogether, it says they killed 20 of them at that point. And so that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. And this began, see, all of a sudden, they're calling out to their security guys, uh-oh, what's going on? They aren't answering. They're like Bruce Willis in Die Hard. They're freaking out because they're losing a person here and there, not knowing what's going on. And so they started getting concerned and getting suspicious of each other. They're waking up, you know, come alert. They're fighting each other. And then God sent an earthquake. So now, like, the ground is shaking. They're, like, freaking out and not knowing where the enemy is, thinking that somehow the Jews must have got a bunch of help. I don't know what's happening. And then it ends up, finally, the rest of the Hebrew army sees, hey, there's something going on. Let's go kill them. At first, Saul does what Saul does. He goes, well, first, I think we should seek the Lord. Bring the Ark of the Covenant here. And then people are like, look, man, these people are dying. So he's like, okay, forget it. Never mind. We won't do the religious thing. Let's just go kill people. So as you read on down through the thing, they're wiping these guys out. It's pretty amazing. But then Saul does kind of a dumb thing because they were winning the battle, but Saul got so pumped up that he said, okay, look, I am declaring that nobody's going to eat. We're going to keep killing people. We're too busy killing people to eat. So nobody eat. I'm taking a vow. If somebody eats, they're going to get killed. So the army is getting hungry. They're having a problem. They're like, this is fun killing people, but man, I could sure use something to eat. You can't do it. In the meantime, Jonathan, if you read down through the chapter, Jonathan didn't hear that his dad said that. And so they found some honey. Nobody would eat it. Jonathan's like, man, I need something. And so he stuck his stick in there and ate some honey. And it says that it brightened his countenance. You know, it's like, wow, he got a real jolt from it. And so because he hadn't heard what was going on, his countenance brightened in verse 27. And one of the people said, your dad said not to eat anything. And Jonathan responded, you know, my father has troubled the land. In other words, my dad is an idiot. So look at me now. My countenance has brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. It's working. How much better, verse 30, if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found, for now there would have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines. Well, they finally drove them back, but now the people are so hungry, they just start eating animals raw, cooking them in their blood, violating their kosher laws. And so then Saul realized, oh no, this is a problem. So then he goes, okay, never mind. We're going to have a special, you know, sacrifice and you can eat whole. Well, in the sacrifice, he says to the priest, ask God, should we go chase the Philistines some more or should we take a break? And he's waiting for God. And so the priest is probably fumbling around with the Urim and the Thummim, and it's like he's shooting blanks. It's just not, he's not hearing anything from God. So Saul says, something's wrong, and I'm going to get to the bottom of it. So he says, we need to line everybody up. And the first thing I want to do is make sure that I point out that it's you guys and not me. So he said, my son Jonathan and I will be heads, and you guys will all be tails, and we're going to flip a coin. And so then, when it's you guys, then we'll have 12 tribes. We'll figure out who's the responsible party for the fact that God isn't speaking to us. But he really was surprised when it came up heads, and then he looks at Jonathan, and he's like, me and you. It's not me, but we'll go ahead and flip a coin, call it in the air. And it came down Jonathan. And he goes, what's up with you? What did you do, Jonathan? And Jonathan goes, look, I didn't hear that you made that vow that you're going to kill whoever eats. So I was weak and tired, and I ate some honey. So kill me. And he's like, okay. I mean, Jonathan's willing to die. His dad's willing to kill him. But kind of an amazing thing's happened in verse 45. He's ready to kill him. You'll surely die, Jonathan, in verse 44. But the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Certainly not. Ain't gonna happen. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. God's been on his side. We're not killing him. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he didn't die. And then for the rest of the chapter, we see Saul's having victories over, you know, Amalekites and different Canaanite people. Won a lot of victories, but in the last verse, in verse 52, there was fierce war with the Philistines all the days of Saul. Never completely wiped them out. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him for himself. Saul still was Saul. He still wanted him to look good. He still wanted other people to fight his battles, and he would take the credit. And so that's the story of Saul and Jonathan. Pretty amazing on both accounts, really. These guys were so different. Jonathan was anything but a chip off the old block. If anything, again, you see why Jonathan later would become best friends with David, the man after God's heart. Because Jonathan was just so different than his dad. And there are contrasts in several different ways. I mean, first of all, as you look at these guys, one of them had a really strong work ethic and the other one didn't. Jonathan was the kind of guy who would get things done. He's the guy who in chapter 13 led the assault on the Philistines. He's the guy now who's going, we don't know what's going to happen, so I'm going to do something. Saul, he was always trying to get out of work. He was, you know, you've known people at work who, they work harder at trying to avoid work than actually doing the work. They can wear themselves out, sneaking around, hiding in the bathroom, whatever. Well, that's him. He's like, sorry, I would have gone after the Philistines, but I was eating pomegranates in the shade. So, what a difference. And you wonder, how did Jonathan become such a hard worker when his dad was sloughing off and he was the king? But there's a difference between them in that for sure. But you also see along those lines, there's a huge difference in their ego. Jonathan had done some amazing stuff already, and he would do something really amazing this time. And yet, he didn't blow his own horn. In fact, the people had to defend him in the end because he wasn't even defending himself. He's like, okay, Dad, fine. You want to kill me? Kill me. No big deal. But what an amazing humility that he would go ahead and fight alongside his dad and that he would help Israel when he would have every excuse not to. Then you see Saul, his dad, everything's about him. He took credit for everything good that ever happened. He tried to surround himself, as we saw in the final verse of the chapter, surround himself by people who would make him look good because he just had this out of control ego, which is weird because when we first came upon him, he was really a humble guy. But power does this to you. Power can turn into ambition very quickly. And so you see two different egos involved with these two, this father and son. But you also, like Jonathan, is an amazingly courageous guy. His dad, kind of a coward, really, wanting to hide, wanting to try to, we got to work something out. Jonathan's like, so much courage. What an adventurer he is that he came up with this idea to do something that frankly was nuts. It was completely crazy. No one ever does anything truly great without being willing to do something kind of crazy generally. Now, disclaimer, just because you do something crazy doesn't make you great, but if you decide that you will never do anything crazy, you'll never be great. Like Steve Jobs said, people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do. And it's true. It's the spirit of adventure, the spirit of courage, this idea of I am going for it is something that without which your life is going to be a blip on the radar screen. The best things you will ever do in your life are going to be things that some people think you're nuts to try that. And when you do things that everybody thinks you're nuts to try, most of the time you're just nuts and it doesn't work. But nothing great ever comes unless you're willing to take those kinds of risks. And so he was the adventure. He's like, let's go for it. I'm all in. I'm going. And I don't know if God had spoke to him or if he just thought, I bet God will have my back. It doesn't say. But anything meaningful that you ever do with your life comes because you're willing to take certain risks. Not risking everything all the time, but strategic risks somewhere along the way. And that's something that for Saul, he never did get that. You don't ever see him doing something truly courageous, truly adventurous, truly at great risk. Jonathan, that was like second nature to him. And that's something that sets these two guys greatly apart. At the heart of their differences, though, is their relationship with God, their spirituality, their who they were in connection with God. Now, for the most part, Saul tried to be a good religious person. Saul tried to follow the rules. Yeah, he messed up in chapter 13 and did a sacrifice, but he had a really good excuse. But here he's like using the Urim and the Thummim, doing the sacrifice, talking to the priest, praying to the Lord. He's doing all the right things. And when he made a vow, he's doing what the law says. If you make a vow, keep it. Saul is so religious that he's ready to kill his own son because that's what the Bible says to do in his mind. So he's a guy who has a very religious perspective. Jonathan, on the other hand, he's more relational in his connection with God. He's not thinking about, for instance, well, I submit to my father, he's the king, I need to ask him before I do this. Nah, instead of asking for permission, I'll ask for forgiveness later. And he goes for it. He has this insight, though, into God's character that he was absolutely right. If he would do something crazy like this, God will bring the earthquake, he will lead them, and they will wipe out these Philistines. And it'll unite the children of Israel. Earlier in the chapter, there's a place where it says a lot of the Jews had already run off to hide in the wilderness. But when they heard about this, they came and joined them. There were a lot of the Jews who had actually flipped, and now they were cooperating with the Philistines. But now all of a sudden they got pride in who they were and they jumped in on God's side. You know, how does that happen? Ultimately, Jonathan's faith, that is, and faith, as Paul says in Hebrews 11, is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith is when you don't know how you're going to get out of this, but you are doing things and saying, God's going to have to show up, and I believe that he will. And Jonathan's such a beautiful picture of faith. And it's kind of the same way with Jesus in his day. You also see this characteristic in David. Well, like for David, for instance, his soldiers were hungry. And at the, you know, in the synagogue, they had showbread that was there for the priests for worship. Nobody else was allowed to eat it. That was the rule. But he's like, nah, give it to us. We'll eat it. And that was scandalous and anti-religious. And later when Jesus came along, Jesus cited that as an example of course, people are more important than rules. And so he allowed his disciples to pick wheat on the Sabbath. It was against the rules, but it was common sense that people are more valuable than rules. And he had to understand that. Now, you know, in the days of Jesus, the Pharisees were the rules guys. Sorry, that's the rule. And that's kind of this level of spirituality that Saul had. He's just trying to follow the rules. But Jesus comes along and says, look, the Sabbath is a rule. But the Sabbath was made for people. People weren't made for the Sabbath. The rules are there to help people, not to hurt people. And so he clarifies that you are not people who live by rules. You are people who live by a relationship with God. And ultimately, what that looks like is what Jesus told them. Let me summarize the whole law. It comes down to this. Love God and love people, and that covers everything. If you follow rules that aren't loving toward God or loving toward people, you misunderstand the rule book. You don't understand what's really all about. And that's what's so fascinating to me about Jonathan, is that he has an insight that says, we're going to do stuff because it makes sense. I'm not going to do things that go against what's best for people and blame God for it. That's the kind of stuff my dad does. His dad was stuck with a rule book. His rule book was, that's how we do life. He had a relationship with God in a way, and I wish it told us what his relationship with God was before this, but probably if it had said, and Jonathan got up early in the morning and you know, prayed to God, if they had said that, then we would make praying to God a rule that would then allow you to be Pharisees or Philistines. So it doesn't say any of that. It just shows you what it looks like, that you step out, that you value people and lives, and that you believe that God is actually on the side of the people who are trying to do the right thing. Not that God would ever want to mess you over. Not that he would want to mess you up. And so Jonathan had that relationship. Saul, he just had a religion. You know, that was it. And ultimately the upshot of it is, Jonathan, he cared about people. Love your neighbor as yourself. It's the same thing as loving God. It's why the script Jesus told him, here's how people will know that you're my disciples. If you are loving. And so making that the standard, Jonathan understood it. Saul didn't. Saul followed rules, but nobody was convinced that Saul really cared about people other than just himself. And so, you know, all of that, you go, these guys are very different. You know, was Jonathan adopted? He just doesn't seem like his dad at all. But a great example for us, but a challenge for us as well. Because in our lives, we need to ask ourselves, what's my connection with God? And a real easy way, by the way, to analyze that is, when was the last time you tried to do something that most people thought was stupid? When was the last time you were willing to do something that was stepping outside the box? When was the last time you did something actually risky that if God didn't show up, that you might look dumb? I mean, that's what life is about. Ultimately, and for all of us, you can measure your effectiveness in how you're living your life based on what risks you're willing to take. It doesn't mean that you take every risk that's out there. That's not wise. This isn't, Jonathan didn't do this the next battle that they had. It was in this case, he's like, what do we have to lose but just two guys? Hey, why not? Maybe God will show up. And I think for those of us who have been followers of Jesus for a long time, what risks are we actually taking? In fact, what are we trying to accomplish? What are we actually trying to do with our lives? If it doesn't involve risks, it's probably settling for something much less than it could be. To listen to God and be willing to be thought of as foolish, to take a chance. You know, it's something, I think it was Brennan Manning who said, to live without risk is to risk not living. It turns out the most important things in life are things that you take a risk for. To live safely is not to live at all. And I think that that's something we need to think about. Am I just kind of becoming like Saul, sitting under my tree, I got pomegranates, I'm good? Or am I going to be like Jonathan, where I go, you know what? This week, I'm going to talk to somebody that they might really be mad at me. I'm going to say something. I'm going to post something. I'm going to do something that I know that there are some people who aren't going to like it. And the reason I'm going to do it isn't just to, you know, piss people off. The reason I'm going to do it is because I know that when God works, sometimes it's when people take chances. If I never take a risk, is it likely that I am ever going to see God show up in a significant way? I mean, a horrible way to live your life is to just be as safe as you can possibly be. I'm not promoting every risk. There are certain risks that you're probably better off not taking. You don't take risks for risk's sake, but if you think, what might God do if I take this chance? Then you're on pretty solid ground at that point to just give him an opportunity. You don't make a big deal about it. You don't broadcast it to everyone. You just quietly do it and go, okay, God, if I'm supposed to do this, then here's what I'll need you to do to confirm to me that this is what I'm doing. By the way, in the process of that from this chapter too, there's something to be said for sticking your stick in the honey and eating a little of it. See, you really can't be used of God if you let your health deteriorate to a point where there's no spark in your eyes anymore. If you're not getting enough sleep, if you're not eating decent, if you're not, you know, once in a while putting some, you know, coffee or honey or whatever in there just to brighten you up, then you're less likely to be able to make it through the kinds of results that come from living a life of risk. And so the wisest thing that Jonathan did here was he ate some honey. Now, I'm not a coffee drinker, but on Sunday mornings, I've three services, it takes a lot out of you. You know, the scientists have said that a pastor who preaches a sermon on a Sunday morning, one sermon is like the equivalent to 8 hours of physical labor in terms of what it takes from you. And I do three of them, and I'm old. And so, because I don't like coffee, I usually use a 5-hour energy drink on a Sunday. I take it right before first service. But a lot of times I forget. I leave them in my office. I get back in the green room, and I go, oh, man, I forgot my... And Jerry's told me like 100 times, put a box of them in here. Nobody's going to steal them. And I go, I know I need, but then I don't do it. So this morning was one of those times I go, uh-oh. So I head to my office. People are you okay? Are you all right? And I don't want to say, look, I'm just afraid that I'm going to fall asleep halfway through second service if I don't go get my caffeine and vitamin B12 and whatever other concoction they put in there. But I realize something that you need to realize too. Managing your energy is a huge part of living a life of risk. If you allow your energy to be depleted, whatever that looks like, however, if it's exhibited in depression or just tiredness or whatever, sometimes you can't kill the goose that lays the golden egg. If you're going to have a life of adventure, then you need to make sure that you're managing your levels of energy. And how, I mean, we're not selling energy drinks. They're not available in the office for you. I'm on our website. I don't know. You know, you have to figure out what it is. I hope you choose something that's legal. But but in this story, it's like life is an adventure. If you don't take care of you, then you're not going to have what it takes to live this adventure. But for all of us, you look at this story, and I think for most of us, we can go, so is my life looking more like Saul's right now or Jonathan's? And maybe we need to make some small changes in our lives. Maybe we just need to take some kind of risk that will just show that we're still alive, that we're still looking for an opportunity. I mean, I am inspired all the time. I have a lot of friends on Instagram and Facebook, and you know, yeah, a lot of it's just ridiculous. But at the same time, I see people courageously telling their stories when they're going through a hard time, and seeing how they are approaching it. And I know one of my friends, Jeanette DeMays, is somebody that I just, when I read her posts, I'm like, that girl just has so much courage. And the way she's attacking life and the way she's confronting it, she doesn't care what you think of her. She doesn't know what's going to happen. But man, she just puts it out there and it inspires me. And you can be an inspiration to other people by your honesty, by your integrity, by your courage, by your being willing to cry sometimes. When you're hurting, there's something strong about that. Don't live the life of the coward that withdraws and lets somebody else deal with all the stuff. Be a person who says, God can show up, so I want to be willing to make myself vulnerable so that if he shows up, I'll have something to applaud him and praise him for. It's a choice that we do with our lives. The life of safety is never fulfilling. It always ends up deteriorating. The life of taking risks to see what God will do, that's inspiring. And something to think about on our Independence Day. It's really easy to get down on, you know, our country, because it's like, if things aren't going your way, you feel like, oh boy, we're just not even a free country anymore. We have so many freedoms. We are so blessed as a nation. You know, I love the story of, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago when Mike Pence took his teenage daughter and a couple of her friends to see the play Hamilton. And people saw the vice president was there and they were booing him. And then the whole cast got up on the stage afterwards and lectured him and booed him. And security had to end up ushering him and his daughter and friends out. And somebody said, how did you explain that to your daughter? And he said, I told her that's what freedom sounds like. That's why I'm proud to be an American. Because people can have idiotic ideas, they can still say them. We're secure enough in the truth that we don't have to be all worried. We are a nation that was founded upon principles of people who are going for it. It looked idiotic to take on the British. I mean, anybody could take on the British today, but back then, they were an actual world power. Those are our roots. But those are our spiritual roots as well. That we are challenged that my life and yours is a gift. What do I do with it? How do I choose to live my life? I'd rather be risky and open to what God will do than to be safe and just let life go by. And I hope if you've never, you know, really come in contact with God through Jesus, received his forgiveness, maybe you've rejected him because it's a risk. It's nothing like the risk of rejecting him, that's for sure. But more than that, more than all of that, it's the gospel is a story of God loving you so much that he wants you to be in his family. And so you talk about risk, Jesus, being in the form of God, according to Paul, thought it not something to hang on to be God, but he emptied himself completely. And he came to the cross and hung there and felt like his Father wasn't there anymore. You know, my God, why have you forsaken me? He did that for us. What a risk. And the fact is, everyone had the freedom to accept him or reject him. And there was no guarantee that millions of people were going to become Christians. It could have just been a handful of people. I mean, most of his disciples had bailed on him by this time. But I look at it and go, God gave me the perfect example of what living a courageous, risky life looks like in order to purchase my freedom. And if you've never received that gift of life, that gift of freedom, I pray that today you'll consider doing that. We're going to celebrate communion, which is a time that we remember his body that was broken and his blood that was shed. So we remember this is how it works. God doesn't conquer the universe by beating everyone into submission. He doesn't save the world by just deciding who gets saved and who doesn't, and then let's just go through the motions and pretend. He risked everything believing that there would be people who would take the bread and drink the cup and say, I'm with you. I am buying into what you have done for me. And that's what communion is. So in just a little bit, we will partake in communion. And I pray that for those of you who have never accepted him, this will be a time when you ask yourself, what's holding me back from receiving a gift of eternal life? Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this great story of Jonathan. So unpredictable, kind of crazy. If we were there, we would have told him, don't do this. But somehow he had a sense of the kind of stuff that you like to do. And he was faithful to that calling. Lord, I pray that we would learn from his inspiration, that we would be inspired by the same God who inspired him, that we would live our lives with courage and conviction, even while we're shaking in our boots, because we're more afraid of missing what you're going to do because we're being safe than we are inspired by the potential of being involved in that which will save people's lives for eternity. Help us to have that clear in our minds. And thank you that we can celebrate your courageous and crazy gift of life for all of us. In Jesus' name, amen.